I thought, I can build a massive following, and that will be a weapon that I can leverage to win the right to invest in your company.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. I'm very pleased to welcome Harry.
Thank you for having me, Bobby. No, I've never done one of these before.
No, he told me he's very nervous having done this 3,000 times already, kind of versions of this and his podcast. So just by way of background, very quickly, founder of 20 VC podcasts, over 100 million downloads in 190 countries. Mm-hmm. From that, you went into building an investment firm and multiple other companies that relate to kind of VC space. Mm-hmm. 10 unicorns, over $1 billion of assets under management. Mm-hmm. And now, as I said, a conglomerate that spans media and investment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a fun 11 years.
Yeah. So we're going to start with a little bit of the personal journey. Yeah. So kind of if you go back to the beginning of this journey, 2015, you're 18 years old, yeah, with $50 and from your bedroom, yeah, you decided you wanted to get into podcasting.
Yeah.
Run us through that journey or that decision and kind of how that started.
I actually feel really sorry for a lot of young people today, because when you speak to them, the most common thing I hear is, I just don't know what I want to do. I don't know what gives me passion. I don't know who I really am. And for me, that actually was never a question. I watched The Social Network when I was 13 years old, and there's a brilliant scene where everyone got inspired to be an entrepreneur from this movie, not me. I saw Peter Thiel invest in Facebook with his hedge fund, Clarium Capital. And being a gaming nerd before with a father who was a trader, I had this weird love of finance and technology. And so this scene was essentially introducing the love child of tech and finance, which is venture. And I just became obsessed with venture. I read everything I could, which was funny, a couple of cool writers in the early days. Venture was not cool then. This was 10 years ago. And podcasting was even less cool. And then when I was 18, I was staring down the barrel of law school, which was incredibly daunting. But fundamentally, I saw venture, and I just thought, what a stale and frankly poor asset class. How undifferentiated, how commoditized, and how uninnovative. And I thought, how does that change as the world progresses? And I thought we would see the celebritization of venture, where people become brands and where fundamentally distribution becomes this weapon that you can leverage and use to win the best deals. Everyone like places a lot of emphasis on like picking. Picking is not the problem in venture, I promise you. Winning is the problem. There is 10 term sheets for every good deal. I'd honestly say 15 plus. The question is, when I stare across the table from an entrepreneur, how do I get them to choose me? And as an 18-year-old, I thought, I can build a massive following, and that will be a weapon that I can leverage to win the right to invest in your company.
So was that always the intent? The podcast was a means to an end to move in. So investing was always the goal?
Investing was always the goal, but I was a dropout. I wasn't very good at maths. I didn't go to university. I didn't go to work at Goldman, because never offered me a job.
Yeah.
So what hope was there for me unless I started this podcast?
It's worked out okay.
It's worked out okay. But it's also the importance of like relationships.
Yeah.
Like really early, I thought that the only thing that will matter would be relationships. And that is the only thing that matters to me. Like if you open Excel on my computer, it says sign in or register.
Yeah.
Like I am the relationships person.
So do you think you touched on it already, you know, around the relationship, the network, the access. So capital, do you feel like that's now become a commodity? And then actually, it is different things that drive the ability to access companies, get on the cap stack, generate the returns.
Yeah, capital is a total commodity.
Yeah.
We just did this deal where they were raising $250 million and they had $4.4 billion of demand. So like, the question is, how do you be part of that $250 million?
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. And that's where, as the cost to create technology has come down dramatically with AI, actually, the ability to distribute it, to get it in the hands of customers, is more valuable than ever. You know, I did a LinkedIn post for one of our companies, and it got 6.1 million in revenue in 36 hours. Now, that's quite a lot for a company that only does 10 million in revenue. That's very meaningful.
And do you think that brand and media is now interrelated to the investing side from the perspective of, you know, your platform is good for these companies in terms of amplifying their voice and consumer awareness of what they do?
100%. Like, it is core to every big founder now. The most common request I get is from public company CEOs saying, can you help me navigate public market storytelling. And they suck at it. They suck at it universally. I don't mean this arrogantly, but they do. They might be great at building a business, but fundamentally they cannot tell stories and they cannot excite people. And so now before a show, we actually do this like tutorial of what makes a great show. And what makes a great show...
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 VCN20210130。
Oh, and I always say this to CEOs, is art and science. The art is the story. And it's, you know, I remember when I was 18, I had no money. I didn't know a VC. I told my mother who was downstairs in the kitchen to unplug the home phones because if the phone rang, gosh, Bill Gurley, who I was interviewing, it would be so embarrassing. That brings you in. It makes you resonate with me. And the science is, and I learned three things from this. Number one, most people fail because they never take the first step. Number two, you need art and science.
Yeah.
I am consistently teaching CEOs now how to tell effective stories.
And that storytelling must be key. If I sit there and think about, you know, that storytelling, loudest voice, shift in how content is digested, you know, kind of, as you said, back then, 10 years ago, when you started, podcasts weren't cool.
Yeah.
Now everyone wants to do a podcast, better or worse, yours is good, some less so. Do you see now that attention span shrinking, it's loudest voice or shortest, snappiest title that captures the zeitgeist or attention? Or what are you seeing through your platform in terms of how people consume content?
We are all just dopamine chasing monkeys, like, just to be very clear. It is about like the SaaS apocalypse, the SaaS massacre, public market turmoil. Like, there's no excitement in, you know, slight dip in performance.
Yeah.
I know, okay. Like Elon Musk versus
Maybe
Sam
for the family offices in the audience, they're like, oh, okay, slight dip better than apocalypse.
Yeah,
but yeah. You're right.
But like, you know, you need like Elon Musk versus Sam Altman with like blood trickling down the thumbnail. That'll get some clicks.
Yeah.
But if you just put, you know, something a little bit more nuanced, no one cares. No one cares. And this is like the other thing, which, and you may be like, oh, rein it in on the content side, but like people don't understand the science of content today. The content is a total science. And so if you don't hit a lesson, a nugget of wisdom in the first 3 minutes, you have an increased churn rate by 82%. So what do? We hijack your mind. We take the best segments, really 3 12-second segments, and shove it in the first 36 seconds. Why? Because then you hear me say, the casinoization of public markets has never been more real. Oh, God, that's in the first 10 seconds.
Oh, and then you've got them for this.
And then you've got them. And that's so important. But we front load the dopamine. And so you're absolutely seeing that. And, you know, for us now, and this is what's so interesting, we create 80 to 100 clips per show. Now, probably 85% of those are created with AI. And so the really interesting thing is then, like, how is it changing how we create content itself?
Okay. If we now move on to the investing side, we've touched on how that was always the goal. If you look at what you think you see in the venture landscape as it is, you know, it feels like competition is as high as ever in that space,
yep.
But people focus on fewer names or some big ticket names that are household names. What are you seeing in that landscape right now?
I mean, let's be honest, we're seeing the destruction of the early stage market. Because the business model cannibalization or shift from large, large multi-stage fund players is so real. What do I mean? You've got platforms with $5-10 billion where seed and series A is a total option. It's a total option. So throwing a 10 on 100, 10 million on 100 million, fine. We just need somewhere to put 100 to 500. We're in the AUM deployment game. That's fine, but it destroys the early stage business.
Mm.
And so that is a very, very big shift that we're seeing. And there's two types of investors in the world today. There's performance, you know, maximizers, which is what we're in. We're here to make as much cash on cash as possible. And we're driven by multiples. And then there's AUM gatherers, and not one right or wrong, but that's, we're here to stack AUM and build a platform and a machine. And the challenge with the platforms and machines is they cannibalize the early stage business. That is really, really tough for us. You know, I think candidly as well, you know, before, growth expectations were so different. I feel so guilty for this generation of entrepreneurs. We always said triple, triple, double, double, which is, you know, 3X, 3X, 2X, 2X, and you'll get great funding. Now, if you're not going from 0 to 20 to 30 million in revenue in a year, next, it's brutal. But the opportunity cost is so real.
Of sticking with those ones that aren't scaling.
100%.
And now everyone wants kind of the sexy thing on their caps table.
100%.
And do you feel that goes through to the end investor? They want to be able to say, I'm invested in, whether it be Anthropic or Lovable, whatever the thing that's become topical in the moment? Or do you think they just want the returns?
I find LPs so fun. I love LPs, actually, which is kind of rare. One of the biggest mistakes managers make, I always find, is they don't understand the importance of relationship building throughout cycles. They fundraise and then they stop. And it's like, that's not how this works. See, I meet two new LPs every week. And at the end of each LP meeting, I say, Bobby, I love this. Can you recommend three to me that you think would be great? And I'll get on with. And so each week I get six new LP recommendations. Okay. You do that every week across a 3-year cycle, because that's how long our deployment timelines are.
Yep.
You build a huge amount of relationships. But one of the reasons I love LPs is candidly, so much of it is just social capital chasing. It is brilliant. Yeah, every single show we do, we get the track record of the GP. So we've got 2,700 tracks, one of the biggest databases in venture. And so a lot of LPs call and say, hey, should we invest with this manager? How does it compare to other managers? Talk to me through like the data that you have. And we obviously help them where we can. And I will say negative, 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 negative. And then I'll say, so are you going to invest with X big platform? Oh, yeah, for sure. It's X platform.
Because it's safe.
Yeah, you don't get fired for doing IBM. And the truth is the majority of large institutional capital is still run by you don't get fired for doing IBM.
You started the podcast. You didn't want to be a lawyer. You enjoyed Freshers Week, but turns out things worked out well for you.
Yeah.
When you sit and you think about empathy, listening to your podcast, and it's one of the things, you're very open, you're very honest. You know, you see that kind of vulnerability and empathy. And I imagine that translates to the business, founders engaging with that, responding to that, capital or commodity.
You have no idea how appreciative founders are when you are willing to show every part of yourself in terms of the emotional vulnerability. Like, you know, in all honesty, when I was 21, managing $150 million, I would drink to escape.
Yeah.
For 22 hours of the day, I had to be incredibly serious and professional and not a 21-year-old. It was not. And since I was 17, 18, I was paying for my mom's MS, and you lose that use. And I will talk to founders about needing that. And in the dark times, needing that person. And I promise you, you can get your platforms, your big firms with your beautiful facilities.
Sorry, I'm not saying that's right.
But actually, when you have that person who like truly bears their soul and says, I will fight and I will be with you every step of the way.
They buy it.
And there's nothing that I haven't seen. They buy that.
How do you find that equilibrium to kind of step out of that? Because you love what you do.
Yeah. No, it's just like, I've never ever met a I've met a lot of $10 billion plus founders. I've never met one that's not psychologically warped.
Yeah. The drive.
That wasn't a joke, but it's very
funny. No, I kind of,
It's true. And so like, I can fundamentally tell within the first minute if I want to invest in a founder. I'll just ask, how was your weekend?
And what they say.
Yeah.
So what are the traits you look for?
Oh, it's super easy. Like, I've interviewed 1,000 of the best founders of the last decade. There's a couple of core traits which really make the best. Number one is the time with which you started your first entrepreneurial activity. No great founders are like, you know, and then I left Bain at 26 and I started my company. Never. You always started making websites, started selling mobile phones, started selling sweets, if you're really going back to the 50-year-old plus entrepreneurs, but you get me.
Yeah.
So the age with which they started. Number two, educational institution, à la poubelle, means nothing. The clan with which you led a gaming community, far more indicative of your success. Oh my gosh. Like, I can tell so much about someone from the level of their gaming skills and the clans with which they led them, versus like an education. You know, Toby at Shopify taught me that one. He really like digs in deep
to the clan and who the,
yeah, how big it is, how it was structured.
Was the alpha in the clan?
Yeah, how it was structured. It's very much like companies. You have to do resource allocation within clans. You actually have to do remote management between different people, incentivization. It's very difficult. And then mostly they're teenagers who are emotionally volatile and sporadic. So it's basically about managing a normal team. And so I would say like those, and then a weird one that is actually more and more important I see is moving frequently in childhood. People who move frequently in childhood are far more likely to be successful as CEOs and entrepreneurs because they're constantly forced to assimilate with new environments, make new friends, leave friends, join new communities.
Adjust, pivot.
Adjust, pivot.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump again. Europe.
Yeah.
You know, Project Europe.
Yeah.
Many lines of press spent on Europe versus US, lack of growth in Europe, the growth ecosystem in Europe. In this deglobalized world, you know, can you touch on what you see the forward is for Europe as a talent sourcing place for tech founders, as a tech ecosystem, as a venture ecosystem?
Honestly, it's wonderful. Like, I used to have to convince founders, you know, stay in Europe, stay in Europe. Now you look at a lot of the domestic situation that happens in the US and they're like, I ain't going there. I don't know. Thanks. It makes my life a lot easier. And then I look and I'm really frustrated with Europe. You know, we don't have someone to chest pump and to say, like, yes, we can. You've got Fixer in a world of superhuman, which is an email client that was going for 8 years with the best from Silicon Valley, Andreessen behind them. Well, Fixer got to their revenue in a year. London.
It's just not a lack of talent.
It's not a lack of talent. It's a lack of chest bumping. It's a lack of people saying, yes, we can. It's everyone's like, oh, it's a lack of growth capital. It doesn't matter where that comes from. It's like a super easy statement to make that all these, everyone comes to these conferences and they go, there's a lack of growth capital and, ambitions have been like increased and the glass ceiling on ambition.
Do you think that now, because we see this a little bit in our business now in the public markets, do you think that there is, we're moving into the era of Europe for Europe?
100%.
And actually, so you feel there's a lack of competition here?
There's none.
You're competing with the US.
Absolutely none. Like, I mean, the quality of European venture is very, very low. I mean, respond that week and you're probably doing good job. I mean, like...
But that's the opportunity, I
imagine. That's a phenomenal opportunity.
And if you look forward now, and you look at all these companies, the speed of company formation, the cost of code, the barriers to entry in many ways are lower, but I take your point of kind of winner takes all a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you fast forward 10 years from now, do you think Europe will build some of the biggest companies in the world or could?
100%.
Yeah.
Unwaveringly so. If you look at, you know, the rise of Sweden just in the last year, year and a half, with Lovable and Nagora, again, in vibe coding against everyone in the US, Lovable is the dominant brand. It's over $350 million in revenue in 15 months. We did that deal, and we did the deal at $3 million in ARR, and by the time the legals were done, and lawyers are brilliant, and they move very fast.
Also, want to add that Harry's girlfriend's a lawyer, so he has to say that.
We love lawyers. Yeah. And by the time we did the legals, it was at 20 million an hour. 3 million to 20 million. And so we were paying 200 or whatever it was. And at the time, when it was 3, everyone was like, so expensive. It was only 10x by the time we did the deal. The speed of growth of companies is just unparalleled. So yes, Europe can.
Harry, thank you so much for joining us today, for being so candid.